Hello, and welcome to Episode 6 of Forgotten Darkness. I'm Andrew Gable. This week, it's back to the United States, Canada too, actually, for a story that I first learned about in a widespread panic song. The weather's always been vitally important to the human race. Rain made our crops grow, after all. It was only natural that we'd begin to search for ways to control when the rains came. Some turned to ceremony, imploring the gods to give us the rain we needed. Some chose to sacrifice, hoping the gods might take mercy on us if we fed them human lives. Some attempted to bypass the gods, using magical spells and incantations to try to bend nature to our will. But in the modern day, we turn to science, things like cloud seeding and the conspiracy theorists' perennial favorite, HAARP. But the next story is from that shadowy realm between science and magic. And maybe, just maybe, it was all big con. Born July 15, 1875, in Fort Scott, Kansas, Charles Mallory Hatfield and his family moved to Southern California when he was only a few years old. He was working as a salesman for a sewing machine company. But Hatfield had another passion, one which was to dominate much of his life from here on, but also a controversial one. Both originally from a drought-prone area, and now living in another extremely dry area, he began to study what's called pluviculture while he was working as a salesman. Now, pluviculture, which is named for Pluvius, the rainbringer, which is one of the forms of the Roman god Jupiter, who is Zeus in Greek mythology, was the making of rain through various means. Native American rain dances and some of the ceremonies of African tribesmen and other people throughout the world were considered early forms of pluviculture. Smoke wafted it from the roof of a building at the Sherman County Fairgrounds in Goodland, Kansas, during a drought in 1891. The smoke was the work of Melbourne the Rain Wizard, an Ohio man who claimed that he could make rain. On the table was a $500 fee that the people of Goodland would pay him if he could alleviate the dry spell that they were currently going through. But although Melbourne's mysterious process continued for several days, Goodland remained dry. Winds had carried the smoke to the northeast, and there was apparently some pretty heavy rainfall there, but Goodland itself remained dry, and Melbourne was forced to depart unpaid. Soon, however, several locals claimed to have figured out Melbourne's method, and three companies, the Interstate Artificial Rain Company, the Swisher Rain Company, and the Goodland Artificial Rain Company, traveled throughout the Midwest, their rainmaking squads signing contracts and collecting fees of between $500 and $2,500, depending on the acreage covered and the amount of rainfall received. A railroad worker named C.B. Jewell also claimed to have figured out Melbourne's process, and he made it public. He didn't charge for his services. He claimed that he could somehow establish electrical communication with the clouds, and then use a mixture of gas, dynamite, and rockets to create rainfall. But his results were very inconsistent. In 1951, controversial Austrian doctor and proponent of orgone energy, Wilhelm Reich, created the device he called a cloud buster, which was a row of aluminum pipes mounted on a metal platform, essentially. cables led from the bottom of the platform and were placed into water. Reich claimed that the Cloudbuster could unblock orgone energy in the atmosphere and create rain. He claimed to have used it to positive effect on July 6, 1953 in Maine. Now, I'm not sure exactly what he means by unblocking orgone energy in the atmosphere, but Hatfield had the most successful method, whatever exactly it might have been. He developed it in 1902. Usually working with his brother Paul, he would construct large wooden towers, usually 20 to 30 feet tall, and on the top of the tower would be mounted a large tub or vat. To this he would add various chemicals, which would merely evaporate up into the air, and as an early article wrote, somewhat floridly, "Ring tears from the eyes of a rain god." By his own testimony and later articles about his work, his method seemed to be most effective if there were a fog or clouds already in the area. He never claimed to have just created rain ex nihilo out of nothing. In January 1904, Los Angeles was in the midst of a drought. Hatfield's first contract was with some Los Angeles businessmen who offered $50 for an inch of rain. He set up his towers in the hills around Tujunga Canyon and set to work. I don't claim full credit for the downpour, but I do say that I was responsible for holding the storm in Southern California as long as it stayed. When I started out, conditions were extremely unfavorable for me. To be sure, there were a few clouds in the sky, but they were scattered and not of the kind that produce precipitation. I reached the Big Tujunga country one evening and set up my apparatus on a point 1,500 feet above sea level. The next morning I began operations. At 5 o'clock in the evening, conditions seemed very much against me. It was very clear with not even a cirrus cloud in the sky. Small cirrus clouds formed the following morning and became heavier as the day advanced. That night the rain began and a heavy downpour set in, which continued until 2 o'clock in the morning. My rain gauges registered 1.28 inches Friday morning. That morning, the rain began again and continued in showers until night. 36 hundredths of an inch was recorded in my rain gauge, making a total of 1.64 inches for the storm, the heaviest downpour, I believe, in the state. My process is to work upon the humidity of the atmosphere. I have tried it 18 times and have had only one failure at Englewood, December 15th of last. On that occasion, I produced so heavy a fog that it dripped from the trees in a steady stream and precipitated 1/100th of an inch of water in my rain gauge. I try my process only when the conditions are most unfavorable, that doubters can not say it is guesswork or just happens so. My apparatus consists of a tower 35 feet high, on top of which are two tanks. One, about 4 or 5 inches deep, is kept filled with water. Evaporation is produced by means of heat. Beside this tank is another containing my chemicals. The fumes from the chemicals, ascending with the vapor from the water, act upon the humidity of the air. Cirrus clouds, always the forerunners of rain, are formed. Gradually these grow larger and shut off the rays of the sun. This permits the formation of nimbus or cumulus, which in reality is rain. The Weather Bureau, however, differed, saying that the rain was merely part of a storm system moving through the country anyway. Nonetheless, the contract was completed, he received the agreed-upon $50, and the rainmaker's career had begun. In December of 1904, after Hatfield publicly announced his intention to create 18 inches of rainfall between that date and May of 1905, George Franklin, who was the meteorologist who had downplayed his earlier Los Angeles efforts, wrote an angry letter to Hatfield, and Hatfield replied, "If you ever make a rain prediction, let me know, and I'll be glad to help you out." Hatfield set up a water factory on the grounds of the Esperanza Sanitarium near Altadena, and once again he and Paul went to work. On December 19th, according to an article in the Los Angeles Times, Hatfield promised rain for Christmas. Sure enough, within a few days, it had begun to rain, and like predicted, it continued through Christmas. And once again, it had paid off. Hatfield received the moniker Wizard of Esperanza in the newspapers for his efforts, and collected his $1,000. Soon, the very word raining was referred to as Hatfielding by many, and the merchants whom he had helped earlier in the year had begun to sell Hatfield umbrellas, which were in actuality just normal umbrellas with vastly inflated prices. Hatfield soon began billing himself as a professor and began lecture tours. But though Hatfield would often reveal much of the method that he used, the exact combination of chemicals remained obscure. He received $250 from the South Yuba Water Company after rainmaking operations near Lake Spalding in Nevada County, and then in June 1906, he was bound for Dawson in the Yukon Territory in Canada, contracted to break a drought there. One Canadian politician, George Foster, feared that Hatfield's efforts would eventually lead to dire global consequences. But the worries were all for naught. Hatfield was unable to fulfill the contract. Though it did rain a little bit, it wasn't in enough of a quantity to satisfy the mine operators who had contracted him. By May of the next year, he was bound for Wasco, Oregon, contracted for 6 inches of rain between May and July. He set up the towers on Gordon Ridge, produced rain, and collected the fee agreed upon. Now, the article that I looked at, it was kind of unclear what exactly that fee was, but there you go. Next, he was bound for the San Joaquin Valley in California and another contract. But the most famous story with which Hatfield is associated, rightly or wrongly, and the subject of the song I mentioned earlier, was still to come. I haven't been able to determine much about Hatfield's activities and contracts in the next decade, but his most famous contract came in 1915. Almost all of his previous contracts in California had been dealing with localized effects of a huge multi-year drought that Southern California was languishing under. Few areas were hit as hard as San Diego. Rumblings had begun as far back as 1912, when a few citizens petitioned the city council to hire Hatfield. The council replied they would not stoop to hocus pocus, and that was the end of that for a few years. By December 20th, 1915, though, still suffering under the relatively parched conditions, and most of the reservoirs quickly drying up, the council relented. They made Hatfield an almost imposing offer. Fill the Marina Reservoir, which could hold an incredible 18 billion gallons of water, and he'd get an incredible $10,000, which, to put it in perspective, is nearly $250,000 in today's money. Undaunted, Hatfield said he could fill the reservoir in a year's time. By January 1916, towers and chemical vats were constructed, and rains began soon after. On January 16th, it was reported that should there be many, many more rains like the present storm, the city will probably have to pay $10,000. It went on, the council was at a loss to know whether or not Hatfield is responsible for the rains. The day after that article ran, several railway lines in the region began reporting washouts and disruption of service. After that, it was 3 more days until the rain stopped. Over those 3 days, Hatfield reported, 13 inches of rain had poured down over the area. In addition to the railway disruption, hundreds of homes were destroyed, and San Diego was completely isolated and able to communicate only via wireless telegraph, and gas mains had to be shut off. People had to be ferried across the street in rowboats. Flood damage reached into San Bernardino and Los Angeles counties, and into Arizona and Mexico. Ships in L.A. Harbor were stranded on newly formed embankments made from the massive amounts of silt washing through the creeks and rivers. But on the 20th, the rains finally trickled to a halt, and Hatfield went to the city council to retrieve his trip fee. But the marina reservoir was not full, so the Rainmaker wasn't paid. San Diego had suffered $300,000 worth of damage. A few days later, on January 24th, the rains began again. The streets of the city were already inundated by the previous rains, and with torrents of water pouring down from the mountains, the Sepulveda Basin Dam near Balboa Park burst. The Sweetwater Dam near La Presa also burst. And then this was followed by the Lower Ote Dam. Between the three dams, billions upon billions of gallons of water inundated the city. By January's end, the torrential downpours had ceased once again. Marino Reservoir was not only full, but had actually begun to spill over the top of the dam. And so Hatfield doused his fires, headed into San Diego to pick up his money. He wasn't prepared for the damage he witnessed. Nor was he prepared for the dozens of town folk ready to lynch him and his brother. The city, needless to say, refused to pay the $10,000, a multi-year legal battle, which I don't believe was actually settled until the 1930s, ensued between San Diego and Hatfield's lawyers. Eventually, the city conceded that it would pay him the money, but only if he agreed to accept responsibility for the $9.5 million in damage caused to the city. So, naturally, that is an untenable solution, and Hatfield declined the payment. Because what's the use of getting paid $10,000 if you have to pay $9.5 million? Hatfield's activities, even assuming they did, in fact, work, may have had little to do with the flood of 1916, to be fair. In hindsight, it appears that the severity of the drought, at least in the San Diego area at any rate, was overstated. It was theorized that the year before might have been an El Nino year, and the ground was wet anyway, and December had seen pretty significant rainfall before Hatfield even showed up. But his legend was made, and from this point on, Hatfield's services would be in demand even more, and the fees people were willing to pay him skyrocketed. The next contract I was able to uncover had him going to Canada once again, this time to Medicine Hat, Alberta, in 1921. He set up shop near Chappis Lake and made $8,000 for 4 inches of rainfall recorded in the month of May. The payment of Hatfield was apparently controversial, however, because some mentioned that the rain was more general throughout Western North America, and it wasn't thought that he had actually caused that. Eventually, it was deemed that the rainfall wasn't significant enough, and he was not asked to come back. In August of 1922, he made a trip overseas, having been contracted by the Italian government to undertake operations near Naples. The outcome of that isn't clear, but as he didn't return to Italy, it too was likely unsuccessful or not satisfactory. He was also in Oxnard, California in March of 1923, and though negotiations to contract him took place, it's uncertain to me whether he was actually ever contracted or not. The Oxnard Press Courier was notably skeptical of the efficacy of Hatfield's work, dubbing it hocus-pocus business. They felt, as many researchers since have, that his rainmaking wasn't really anything more than carefully examining weather reports and rainfall trends in various areas. Thus, he contracted in areas where he knew, or at least strongly suspected, that there would be significant rainfall anyway. His apparent lack of success in Italy, one could claim, would be more likely to be explained by this view because he would be simply less familiar with Italian weather patterns than American ones, and therefore he couldn't predict when it was going to rain. 1925 saw successful contracts at Tulare Lake and Coalinga, as well as Napoleonville, Louisiana, and Morton County, Kansas. After that, Hatfield's activities seemed to have ceased for the most part. He'd pop back up in the newspapers from time to time, but it seems that the stigma of his association with the San Diego flood and several unsuccessful contracts brought an end to his career. Hatfield went back to selling sewing machines. He offered to help break a drought near Fresno in 1934, but the rainmaker had sunk back into obscurity. He died in 1958 in Pear Blossom, a small town near Palmdale, California. He never did reveal the combination of chemicals that he used. Now, cloud seeding is a controversial practice, which involves some sort of chemical compound, which is usually silver nitrate, dry ice, or sometimes even table salt, projected into the atmosphere. This can be done via an airplane or a ground delivery system. Electronic pulses have also been experimented with as cloud seeding vectors. Now, although the fact that cloud seeding does produce altered precipitation, as I'm understanding it, isn't really the issue, the controversy concerns whether it's a significant increase in precipitation. Ecologist Rob Jackson of Stanford University says that while I think you can squeeze a little more snow or rain in some places under certain conditions, that's quite different from a program claiming to reliably increase precipitation. The thing is, this is really extremely similar to what Hatfield said he could do. He always claimed, after all, that some moisture in the air had to exist anyway. There had to be cloud cover. Now, electronic pulses, actually, certain newspaper articles mention that he used electronic pulses as well. There's no data on whether simple evaporative processes, like what he claimed he was using, would effectively distribute cloud seeding materials, but part of me wonders if maybe he had hit on one of the chemical compounds necessary for cloud seeding. Possibly the best summation of Charles Hatfield, though, came from the recollections of J.J. Prendergast. Prendergast was an executive of the Bear Valley Mutual Water Company, who was engaged in talks to possibly hire Hatfield to work his rainmaking to fill Big Bear Lake in San Bernardino County, and went so far as to construct a wooden tower for his use, which they actually left there for a number of years. Although it seems like Hatfield was never actually contracted at Big Bear, Prendergast later recalled, "I would say he used a lot of big words that I didn't know the meaning of, and I was pretty sure he didn't either. But I never thought he was a faker. He was most sincere. He was merely trying to work with things of which he had no real knowledge." And that's the end of this episode. A list of sources consulted for this episode can be found in the show description. If you have a question, a comment, or know a lesser-known story that you'd like to see covered, leave a comment on the podcast page, post it to our Facebook page at Forgotten Darkness Podcast, or send it to our email at ForgottenDarkness77, lowercase f, lowercase d, all one word, @gmail.com. Oh, and real quick, before I leave off here, thanks to Project Archivist, who mentioned me on their last episode, and, well, actually, the last two episodes, I should say, actually. So, thank you, guys. Rogan was helped me out when I was setting this up. And so, until next episode, this is Andrew signing off.